This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. One rule for the powerful, another for the powerless. One rule for the rich and another for the poor. Or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Clean Up on Aisle 45. This is episode 90. It's Wednesday, October 5th. And joining me today, because Andrew is in Italy, like just, you know, having a wonderful time on his vacation, is Pete Strzok. Hey, Pete, how are you?
I'm good. I, like you, am not in Italy, but we will make do with Northern Virginia and Southern California, which is almost like Italy in its own way, in their own way.
Yeah, I think if you combine them, it's still probably nothing like Italy, but...
but no, not at all.
but here we are. And yeah, I appreciate you holding down the fort with me this week. And the reason I wanted to bring you in is because you are an expert in counterintelligence and espionage. And by the way, another person named Anna, who from Russia, was arrested last week on espionage charges. I don't know what it is with Anna's, but I think you have a little bit of experience with Russian spies named Anna. So I thought that was an interesting little tidbit.
Yeah, that was. Last week was busy. There was a lot going on. There was the couple. There was also some announcements made about some old Chinese economic espionage cases. I think somebody was sentenced or is due to be sentenced. And then, of course, there was the third thing, which I'm probably forgetting, which is also a...
Oleg Deripaska.
Yeah, well, Deripaska for sure. And in addition to Deripaska, I want to say there was somebody else who was arrested talking to an FBI agent he believed to be a foreign intelligence officer, in addition to the couple. But my mind is suddenly drawing a blank. But there was a lot going on.
Yeah, a lot in espionage, which I thought was really interesting timing. Like, I don't know, somebody like woke up the espionage monster and now all of a sudden we've got all these cases going on. But I, you know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you know, because we've been following very closely here on Cleanup on Aisle 45, the whole Mar-a-Lago document debacle. And we saw that recently the Department of Justice put forward a pretty succinct motion for an expedited briefing schedule to the 11th Circuit for their full appeal. And their basic, what they're sort of putting forth here is like, look, we really needed to have that stay lifted on the classified documents because of national security risks and that being inextricably linked to a criminal investigation. But also, you know, these other 11,000 documents are still very important to our criminal investigation, and we're the executive branch, and that is one of the important jobs of the executive is criminal investigations, and those usually outweigh any privilege claims. And so we're, you know, we're going to appeal the entire thing, which they put a notice to appeal the entire Cannon's entire thing earlier on, but they really wanted to get that classified document stuff settled, which they did. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit first about why. Well, let's talk about why the non-classified documents, because Brandon Van Grack, you know, former colleague on the Mueller investigation, and then ended up heading up the FARA unit briefly at the Department of Justice, now back in private practice, said, look, AG, it's not irrelevant. These non-classified documents aren't irrelevant to the investigation. And because they, you know, the fact that they were commingled with these classified documents is important to the criminal investigation, which is an executive branch function and can often outweigh privilege claims. So you've handled this kind of investigation before. Can you talk a little bit about why the non-classified documents being commingled with the classified documents, particularly like in his office or in his desk drawers, have, you know, need to be criminally investigated for things like 2071 concealment, obstruction, and 793 espionage?
Sure. So there are a lot of reasons. I mean, the easiest way to maybe talk about this is to start at a very granular level and talk about the investigative reasons. DOJ would and the FBI would want access potentially to all those documents. And then I think there's a broader strategic long-term decision that's going on here. And we can talk about that at the end. But, you know, as you said, as Brandon said, there is, whether or not, you know, it is particularly interesting because they're commingled, but even if they weren't, it's important to remember that there are three charges listed. In one was dealing with classified information, two were not. One was dealing with obstruction, the other was, you know, illegally essentially maintaining a record that he wasn't entitled to have. But those two things, those latter two criminal charges, have nothing to do with classified information one way or the other. And what is important, you know, the classified documents, presumably, except for maybe the ones where he may have written something on it, those aren't his thoughts, those aren't his writing, those don't speak to his state of mind. All those are something that the U.S. intelligence community or U.S. government has produced that's classified that he had. What's interesting, though, and, you know, we don't know what's in the unclassified material, but I'll lay out a bunch of potential hypotheticals, which hopefully will illustrate to your listener why those might be really relevant to investigators. Say in that batch of unclassified material, there's a folder that's labeled material to give to Rudy to give to Derkach. Right? That would indicate that, you know, something that would give an idea why Trump was holding on to those classified documents. It's one thing to sit there and say, well, you know, these documents exist in the abstract, but we have yet to hear, I mean, we've heard no explanation from Trump, no explanation from his attorneys, why on earth he wanted to keep it. But if he had it in the context of files having to do with Rudy, or files having to do with MBS or Saudi Arabia, or files having to do with something for a business deal in a golf course that he wants to open, or a new Trump property somewhere in Azerbaijan, it might give you an idea of the context of why he was holding on to those documents. The other thing, independent of the documents themselves, perhaps there are communications between him and his attorneys, between him and his staff saying, you know, on the one hand, don't tell the government that I have these documents. Feel free to let the government in the storage room, but please don't tell them about anything that's in my office. Things to his attorney saying, just do what you have to do to get them out of my hair. Tell them I don't have any. I haven't really looked, but tell them that I have. There are any number of communications that he might have had either with his attorneys or non-attorneys that would speak to his knowledge of, you know, things like, hey, of course I never declassified these. They're still classified, but I'm going to say that I did declassify them. Or gosh, I might be in trouble. I didn't know that I should have declassified them. What can I do now? There are any number of things in there that, while unclassified, would be very, very relevant in terms of understanding his state of mind about what he knew, what he didn't knew, why he was trying to conceal, whether he was trying to encourage others to conceal or obstruct the FBI's investigation. And even if some of these were with his attorneys, there's something called a crime fraud exception that you don't get to sit there and say, anything I say to my attorneys, no matter what, is privileged and you can't ever see it. If you're engaged in a criminal act with your attorney, there's something called a crime fraud exception where the government, you know, meeting a certain threshold of proof, can get that information, and essentially that pierces privilege, that they can use it. So all these things go to very important elements of each of the crimes that if you're going to prove that in a court of law, you're going to have to prove some of these things separate and distinct from just, oh, this document was appropriately classified. So all those are examples. I think there's a broader issue here. And I think DOJ started very narrowly with just wanting the classified documents back, saw that Deary, the special master, was, you know, moving ahead with a very reasonable, not rapid, but a very sort of deliberate, meaningful pace to get this out of the way. And then Cannon steps in and undoes all this and throws all kinds of sand in the gears and pushes the schedule way into the next year. And I think DOJ looked at that and said, okay, this is too much. This is not something, not only in this case, we don't want precedent set. We don't want every single high level, any defendant sitting there saying, I want a special master. I want to delay this for months and months and months. And that this judge, you know, in my opinion, clearly abusing her discretion, clearly well outside of her role of a U.S. District Court judge, is doing something that DOJ wants to send a clear message through appeal. This isn't something acceptable. So I think there's also a broader strategic thing going on as well. And that's why I think, I don't know that DOJ envisioned this expedited appeal until Cannon sort of mucked around with Deary's process and flow. And it was only after that that you saw the government step in and file this appeal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she even went back on her original briefing schedule, which was supposed to be finished by, I think, in her initial order, November 30th. But then again, when the amended plan came out, she pushed it back to December 16th. And yeah, with the broader appeal here, they're really going to go after jurisdiction here. They're going to argue that there was no equitable jurisdiction because, as they say, you cannot have equitable jurisdiction over inequitable behavior or acts. And, you know, that's when I used the whole example of that, you know, that we've all seen on America's Dumbest Criminals or Cops or whatever, where the lady tries to do a crack deal with a guy and he rips her off. And so she flags down some police officers and says, hey, help me get my money back. And that's inequitable behavior. And you can't, you know, we can't help enforce a law that you broke. Now, with regards to the lawyers and the crime fraud exception, I think what's interesting here, and Carol Lenig and Dawsey and the rest put out in the Washington Post that she's lawyered up. We knew that, but that she's also willing to cooperate with the Department of Justice. And what's interesting about Christina Bobb is she was also in the Willard on January 5th, and she was on a phone call to try to coordinate the fraudulent electors. So she's got her hands in a lot of stuff. But the thing about the crime fraud exception with her is that she went on television and said she was not a lawyer in the documents case. She was just a documents custodian. So she openly obliterated an attorney-client relationship with Donald Trump and will not be able to claim at all attorney-client privilege, though she might try some executive privilege stuff. Does the crime fraud exception apply to executive privilege?
I don't know. That's a good question. I can't imagine it would. That seems to be the whole my understanding of the theory and the intent underneath crime fraud piercing any sort of privilege, that it would apply to executive privilege in a similar way that it would to attorney-client privilege. But I'm not the right person to ask about that. But I mean, it seems to me Nixon couldn't sit there and claim executive privilege over the Watergate tapes, you know, that were you know, evidence of the break-in and of other crime.
Yeah, but I think in that case, the decision was based on the fact that the criminal investigation took precedent over an executive privilege claim, which is kind of a sort of backdoor around into crime fraud exception, because we're criminally investigating something. But, you know, we'll see. What have you ever had a case where somebody wrote personal notes on a classified document and therefore magically made it a personal document?
No, because I think that's this is what makes this so unique, right? I mean, this is what there are privileges that attach to the executive, to the president, that don't exist with, you know, if you're secretary of some department in the U.S. or some high ranking, you know, CIA director or something like that. You don't have that same sort of executive privilege claim.
But then they would become presidential records, wouldn't they? Which are still
right. Yeah. They're still right. Right. And so some of it is, you know, he can't, you know, except for Judge Cannon keeps giving him his cake and letting him eat it too. You can't sit there and say on the one hand that, you know, these are my notes and therefore there's an executive privilege in there, because then they do become, I think, by all accounts, a presidential record. So it isn't something, you know, if he had taken a document and wrote a note to Patsy Baloney saying, hey, you know, what do you think about this, this, and this? And then send it to the White House counsel's office, there's no indication anything like that exists. That would be the closest thing I could sit there and say, okay, well, maybe that's some sort of, you know, in addition to just presidential privilege, there's some sort of potentially, you know, attorney sort of counsel and deliberative privilege in there. But I'm not the right person to sort of unpack whether or not any sort of presidential privilege, executive privilege could be pierced by a crime fraud exception.
Yeah. And there's just so many novel concepts going on with this case, because we're talking about a former president who was stealing and concealing and lying about having documents. We've really never had anything like this because, you know, as the DOJ argued, even if these are just presidential records, you do get access to them, but you do not have possessory ownership of them. And you also can't lie about, I mean, it's just, it, everything that seems so obvious and clear to us, he has this way of coming in and sort of mucking it up, you know, flooding the zone with shit, as it were, per, you know, Steve Bannon, to kind of confuse the issue. And he gets into these legal weeds that make no sense, that confuse people, and when we should just be looking at the big picture. Like, you took them, you lied about having them, you didn't say they were declassified right when you handed a Redwell double wrapped envelope over. That's not how you treat declassified documents. So, you know, I'm wondering if he's saying, well, those are the ones I didn't declassify and I handed them over, all the rest I declassified. You know, like, I don't know all he can do is delay.
It's all in bad faith. It's all in bad faith. There's nothing there that is like a legitimate reason that he's given. You know, it is all a lie. It is all, I think, you know, a means to, he got caught doing something he shouldn't have done, and he's trying to weasel out of it. Then it's like, you know, everything else he tends to do, he just mucks around. And it's like, if you try and listen to like some, or watch some of these PowerPoint presentations that Mike Lindell gives about how the vote was stolen, it's all argle bargle. It just, none of it, it doesn't make sense. And if you try and like, okay, let me try and follow along what he's saying, it makes no sense. It is just this incoherent rambling of word salad that has no basis in law, has no basis really in fact, but because he's like, well, he's the former president, this is what he's trying to explain himself, you try and follow along, and it's all bullshit. It really is. And all these filings create this overlay of, you know, both sort of legal propriety, because they're legal words, and because they're legal words, they also can get confusing to a non-attorney. So it has that double effect of like, I don't really understand it, and oh, it's a lawyer saying it, so it probably might be more credible than something coming out of Trump's mouth. So, but it's all designed to obscure the truth, and that's that he took the shit that he shouldn't have taken.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of what we learned in the seditious conspiracy Oath Keepers trial this morning. Their defense, well, we learned it a little bit earlier with their pre-trial filings, but they're saying, hey, everything we did was legal. We stashed our weapons in Virginia. We didn't bring them in to D.C. We were waiting for Donald to use the Insurrection Act to call us up as a militia, and we are a legit militia under the, you know, under the law or the Constitution. And so everything we did was legal, and therefore we can't be possibly guilty of seditious conspiracy. And I, again, I feel like that's using deceptive legal language to argue something that's blatantly obvious. I mean, the Department of Justice has brought, what, like 5 seditious conspiracy cases in the last 80 years. They've won like one of them or 2 of them, maybe. I mean, they rarely bring this charge. This is Merrick Garland is not he's an institutionalist, and I bet it took him a minute. I mean, when Mike Sherwin wanted to bring seditious conspiracy against the Oath Keepers, Garland was like, no, no, he turned him down. But when, you know, the new U.S. attorney got in there and got the evidence and got the right stuff together, came back after Sherwin went on 60 Minutes and said, we're thinking about seditious conspiracy charges, almost blew the whole case. The new U.S. attorney in D.C. buttoned it up and brought it back to Garland, said, look, this is unequivocally seditious conspiracy. And Garland had to, I'm sure Garland had to okay that. I just don't see in any world that he would if they didn't think they had an airtight case here.
I hope so. I think that's right. I think, you know, there's no telling where a jury ultimately is going to land. I mean, I think the goal of the prosecution will be to say, it's not that complicated. Look at what they did. Look at the video of what happened. And just believe your eyes and believe the evidence when the defense is going to try and muddle it all up with, you know, the Insurrection Act, which I don't know how that necessarily would give the Oath Keepers or anybody else authority to bring, you know, guns and weapons into D.C. But, you know, they're going to try and throw everything out there to try and if they can confuse one juror enough to sit there and say, well, I don't know, then you've got, you know, you either deadlock the jury and you get a mistrial or they're acquitted. So they just need to get a juror to, you know, buy into whatever crazy nonsense. And it will be, you know, it's like, again, all these folks, it's like arguing with sovereign citizen. And, you know, they've got these false writs and they're going to do, you know, we're going to put a lien on your house and they're going to effect a citizen's arrest. And it's all this, like, it's this made up universe that, you know, collides into the real justice system. And I hope, like has happened so many times, that when this kind of land a make-believe law, you know, the pony unicorn law of MAGA-land hits the reality of the U.S. justice system, that it, like it has so many times, it just kind of crumbles because it's all made up. There's no factual logical basis for it. And, you know, thank God those sorts of things have not survived in our justice system.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, too, that the Oath Keepers are on the hook for multiple other charges, including obstructing an official proceeding, which has been won by in jury trials 100% of the time when it's brought. They've got a lot of guilty pleas. They secured a lot of guilty pleas on that. It carries the same max sentence as seditious conspiracy. So we could see a thing where a jury might be like, well, you know, they did, you know, maybe not seditious conspiracy, but these other charges, juries can do that. They don't have to say all or none. So we will see what happens in that trial. It's expected to last 3 to 4 weeks. But back to the Cannon thing, audio tapes were released today from Maggie Haberman, who's had them for a year and a half, of Donald Trump admitting on tape that he took, for example, he said the Kim Jong-un letters and kept them at Mar-a-Lago. That's a crime. And we have him on tape admitting to it. And if that letter, now here's my question, that's a non-classified thing. If that non-classified document was commingled with classified documents, and he admitted to having and taking the Kim Jong-un letter, does that sort of give credence to him taking the classified documents as well? I mean, is that kind of why these non-classified documents are so important?
Sure. That's one of the reasons. Sure. I mean, one of the reasons is absolutely, there are just so many, you know, I can sit here and come up with dozens of hypotheticals, and that certainly is one of them, right? That if he is admitting to saying, you know, I kept these things for this reason, and then, you know, whatever, there was like some leather-bound volume. I've seen some reporting that was in the office that seemed to be, it's like his little, you know, holy of holies, but, you know, whatever was in there. If there were some documents where he said clearly, yes, I'm keeping these 17 things because, you know, they're all important in some way, and of those 17, 5 are classified, 12 are unclassified, it you know, and those 12 speak to why he was keeping it. It conveys sort of knowledge and selection and reasons for why he'd want to keep it. So yes, for sure, that's one of those reasons. And, you know, the flip side is, you know, conceivably there could be an instance where, you know, whatever that day's events where he was just shoving shit in a box and there was no rhyme or reason to it, it might be a little bit mitigating, saying, well, look, I didn't really select any of this. This was just, you know, the documents from June 15th of 2019, and I just shoved it all in the box without really paying attention to what was in there. So it could cut both ways. I think the likelihood that there are things that are inculpatory, things that are very relevant to the investigation, I'm almost certain there are multiple examples of that in the unclassified material. But yes, for sure that, you know, things he has said about the unclassified stuff is going to inform his state of mind about the classified stuff that he was keeping as well.
Now, what about some in the DOJ, you know, as instructed, did their homework and put together a more detailed inventory of what they took on August 8th. And it matches pretty well with their first inventory. A couple of changes. But I noticed in both inventories, there's a couple of folders that say return to military liaison or return to Pentagon or return to something so-and-so. What are those? Do some classified documents come in folders with instructions on them like that to make sure the chain of custody is followed? I don't think I've ever heard of any kind of a direction on a folder like that.
Yeah, I think that depends on the administration and how they route information into and out of the Oval Office or up to the residence. And I can envision a scenario where he was, you know, in addition to the PDB, if he had some sort of read folder that somebody from the Situation Room that they might use, a military officer, an aide to attaché, to bring him material and to bring it back. But that's something that, you know, you'd probably have to speak to somebody who is in sort of the admin side of the White House operations to give you a rundown of like what that was and how they managed that flow. But I think
wondering too if they like put those instructions on there, because he famously just kept shit and didn't follow directions.
That's a question I haven't heard really asked by anybody in a position to ask it. And maybe one of the intel committees will do it. But like at some point early on, everybody in the White House knew that Trump was a record-keeping disaster, right? Early on, like from the I fired Comey, and he's sitting there telling Lavrov about a great, you know, weight being lifted, and he's sharing allegedly, you know, foreign allied classified information with him early in the presidency, like within days of the beginning of the presidency, people understood this guy was a classified information handling disaster, right? Everybody knew it. And so why did not somebody, way before we ever get to Mark Meadows, when we have quote-unquote, you know, reasonable, competent chiefs of staff, Rents, Priebus, and Kelly, and, you know, whoever else was in the role, why did not somebody, or somebody on the intelligence community side of things, say, hey, look, we need a very rigorous classified document flow management process, right? So that before anything touches Trump, we have a very detailed list of what is given to him. And then when it comes out, we line it up and check off what either we got back or what we didn't get back. Now, we're not going to be able to go to the man and say, hey, sir, look, you left these five things out. We want them. But at a minimum, there would be some fucking record out there that would sit there and say, here is the body of material that was given to Trump and not given back. Why? Who? Because all of these people carrying it in all have a history of handling extraordinarily sensitive classified information. All of them have signed all the non-disclosure agreements. All of them have taken polygraphs. All of them have been sworn for the very sensitive stuff, gone through all kinds of extra hoops. All of them know how sensitive it is. And every single time, now apparently hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, based on what's been seized, stuff never came out that went in. Didn't anybody say, hey, we need to start keeping a log of this?
Well, I think we have some burrowed employees, Patel, for example, at the Pentagon. He wanted to put Michael Ellis over in the NSA. I think he had people in these agencies that would bring him this stuff and not keep a record of where it went. Honestly, we're in speculation land now. But, and I also, that's why I asked, maybe this, you know, return to Pentagon instructions were placed on some of these things that and maybe they don't normally do that, but you know, they had to say, well, we need to remind him that he can't keep this, or that when he's done with it, it has to be returned. But why there wouldn't be a log? Why? Or if, you know, maybe there is. Maybe there are people in the intelligence community, career prosecutors, that know about this stuff, and there are logs and there are things missing, and that's how they knew things were missing. But it you know, they didn't really do anything at the Department of Justice until the National Archives stepped in and said, hey, we got these 15 boxes back and there were classified documents in it. That shouldn't have been a surprise, but it seems like it was.
Right. Agreed.
Yeah. So that's frightening. Given, you know, I've handled some top secret documents. You've handled tons. And you and I know the rigor that goes into reviewing, handling, guarding sometimes those documents, and keeping track of them. So it's very confusing to me as to why in May the National Archives came to the FBI and said, hey, we found these, and the FBI went, whoa, we didn't even realize they were gone. Like how did, I don't understand how those kinds of things flew under the radar. Are there, here, I have a classified documents question for you. Are there safeguards in classified documents that prevent them from being copied or photographed? I've been wondering about this. Back in my day, no, you could copy anything. But I'm wondering if there's some new kind of, you know, how banks have watermarks on checks and stuff. Is there something in place like that with super classified documents?
I think it depends on a lot of things. Yeah, and I don't want to get into too much discussion of it. I would say that, you know, what happens in the White House is going to be very different from what happens in most intelligence community agencies. And so, you know, the issue would be how you, whatever you do to track it, whether something's printed, how it's printed, controls that may or may not be obvious. I don't know what happens in the context of when it goes to the president. And so whatever things might exist, I think, are not going to potentially be as effective or available.
Ah, I see. It's a secret. Okay, that's fine. Because, you know, I was wondering about in the White House National Security Council, there's the NICE, the NICE system, where they, you know, where they, Michael Ellis, the lawyer, shoved the Zelensky transcript to keep fewer eyes on it. And there were, you know, almost half a dozen to a dozen Putin phone calls that might have ended up in there. I'm wondering about all that and who has access to that now, and if they're looking at it even, or if it's kind of like, oh, let's just move forward. You know, it just feels weird.
That's a good question. That was a thing that was interesting, is like, what sort of records, you know, A, did people go in at the end of the administration and destroy all that? You know, Eisenberg and he was on doing a lot of that movement and directing them to be placed in that system. Now, there's a lot of really, really sensitive information that goes on that system. And the question would be everything from, you know, the transcript of the call with Zelensky, anything with Putin, all the, you know, the translator notes that Trump ordered that, you know, his translator turned over, all those things, you know, where did they go? And were they maintained or were they destroyed? You know, who did anybody go back and look at that from the perspective of, you know, setting aside, you know, he's the chief executive, however crazy he might view his role in the U.S. national security, just to look and see if there's any crime there. I don't know. And do they still exist?
Yeah, I feel like, yeah. I feel like if I were in an intelligence agency, I would day one be like, all right, inventory of everything we know we're supposed to have now. Go now. But I have no idea how that works. And I don't know. I don't know what it looks like. There's just so much that I feel like, and you know, this is the government. You and I worked for the government for a very long time. We know how things can fall through the cracks and get lost. And I hate to think of that in these top, these super classified, this, you know, this intelligence.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, like, ironically, you know, in the it might have gotten, like many other things, just overwhelmed by the kind of flow and course of events, and nobody has the time or resources to look back. But because you have this maintenance of classified information at Mar-a-Lago and potentially elsewhere, might cause people to then go in and start asking questions that otherwise might have got just kind of left in the dust of the past. But now, you know, if somebody says, okay, well, you know, we have an issue with records, so let's go into the NSC system and figure out if there are records in there and go through and take a closer look at it. Who knows? I mean, I would want to know that as an investigator, but I don't know where, you know, the scope of what the investigation is or where they're looking or what NARA may or may not be doing in the context of asking for things to get turned
over. Yeah, and I mean, you know, with...
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
You know, within the government, there are audits we can run that can be referred to the Department of Justice if malfeasance is found. You don't have to open a full-on criminal investigation to find out if some stuff is missing. There's steps. We'll see what happens with all this. But back to this appeal, and it, you know what's interesting to me is that I think that the government was very reasonable. They said, "We would like October 14th for us to file our full appeal. And then November 4th, we would like a response from Donald. And then November 11th, we'll reply." They really truncated their own reply times and only shaved, I think, 9 days off of Donald's. And then they said, as far as oral arguments, we'll let the court set the matter at its earliest convenience, whether that be the first available calendar after the end of the expedited briefing schedule or through a special sitting. But they didn't put a date on it. But then the Trump team comes back and says, "What do you mean you're only going to give us 21 days? All right, you can have your till the 14th. We want our full 30 days. And then you can have another 7 days if you want." So that would be a November 20th. It would push it back 9 days because they want their full 30 days to reply, which, you know, I think probably reasonably they could get, just because that's the general rule, is you have 30 days. But, you know, the DOJ has a very good argument that we need these sooner rather than later. And this is, you know, our executive stuff. This is with regards to the non-classified documents. But then they argue, the Trump team argues, but we don't think oral arguments should happen until next year, January. And that, you know, right. because, well, and you can feel the push and pull because Kyes is actually on this, has signed this, and he was sort of sidelined.
Yeah, and Trusty, just it's only those two, Kyes and Trusty, none of the other kind of weirdos.
But you could feel the Kyes parts, and you could feel the Trusty parts. Like in one footnote, and this is totally Trusty, we just want you to know we still think that the DOJ and the FBI are fucked up tricksters, and so, you know, please refer to what we think in our original reply to the motion for a stay or whatever back in the canon times. We just want to let you know we still feel that way. And Kyes was probably like, can we not say it all and spell it out? Can we just refer to our previous filing, you know, so that we don't look like assholes here? What was funny was the reason for January was, look, it'll be November 20th, and then you got Thanksgiving, and then, you know, December, where the government doesn't
do any
work. Nobody
does anything in December, right?
So January's reasonable. We think that's reasonable. And
yeah, we just want to wait until the next Congress gets sworn in is what they want.
And exactly. And then Trusty comes back in, what seems very Trusty-esque. And let me see if I could find the paragraph here. The government can't possibly be prejudiced if this appeal is not expedited and Trump is afforded a few extra days. Additionally, Trump respectfully requests oral arguments be completed in, with the rules of the court. And finally, and here's where Trusty, and I call it the Trusty stank. He says, finally, the extraordinary circumstances herein presented, an investigation of the 45th president by the administration of his political rival, would countenance against any rush to judgment. Indeed, the public interest is served best by transparent, thorough consideration of all the issues. So he's actually saying the public interest is in favor of delay rather than getting these documents back for an investigation.
Give me a break. But the public interest, there's no, and they're hanging this all on this nonsense thing about, oh, it's the president, the first time ever being, investigated by his rival. And it's so, there's no public interest in investigating crime.
Well, and that hints at malfeasance. That hints at it's a political hit job, which it is not. And that drives me bananas.
Right. Right. Yeah. I was looking. Yes, I agree. It's hard to.
You can say fuck on this show, Pete.
Yeah, no, I know. I've already sworn. I don't need to modulate my frequency of it, so it's more effective. It's more impactful.
I see. Right. So yeah.
So I can't imagine that the circuit would let this lay until that long.
There's three perfectly good working weeks in December to have a 1 or 2 day oral argument.
And we're in the beginning of October, so that's 2 months away from that. I think we'll see something before then. And I anticipate
could even see something between in that last week of November, that week before Thanksgiving, which is at the end of November. Feasibly, if they have an open calendar or do what the DOJ said, a sitting, a special sitting. But I gotta say, reading the 11th Circuit's last decision, I don't think they're taking any shit from the Trump team on this, honestly. And these are two of these are Trump appointees, but they have the supreme executive thing in their head, these conservative courts. I'm happy at the way the DOJ has posed these arguments in that light. Do you know what I mean? They're really speaking to the 11th Circuit.
Yeah, and they have to. I mean, it's written. There's a different way. It's interesting. You write, haven't dealt much with appellate law. There have been a couple of cases that have moved up to the circuit court and one that touched on the Supreme Court, but it's a very different way of writing, and you get different attorneys at DOJ. Like, you won't get typically AUSAs when it moves to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and certainly up to the Supreme Court. That's where you get, LC and the Office of Solicitor General writing it, and it is a very different way of writing. It's a very different argument. You're not arguing facts. You're arguing sort of concept of how the established facts apply to the law. So you don't get a lot of argument about what happened. It's more argument about the way the law has been applied or not applied. So it's just a very different, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but as a non-lawyer reading it, you're like, wow, this is, you know, you, what you said, you look at it and it's just a very, it is a different flavor and feel for what you'd see in some district court argument.
Do you think the court will agree that the non-classified documents are just as important to the criminal investigation as the classified documents?
I don't even know that they'll say justice, or that they'll make it a relative judgment one way or the other. I think what they'd say is, you know, whether or not that the executive has the, you know, in the context of doing what the executive does, investigating crimes, that it is, I would imagine, that the district court overstepped in doing some of the, you know, granting some of the relief that it did, and that it isn't appropriate given the separation of powers, that it is not within the district court's right to do what they did and throwing out a bunch of stuff. Now, again, whether that sort of like returns it to say you can't do any of this and, you know, restart something or do something, I just, you know, I don't know that it would, I don't know how this impacts the timing, but I do think it's pretty clear that what Cannon has done has greatly outstepped the role of the judiciary in Article 3 in the context of Article 2 powers.
Yeah, well, so
I would anticipate the circuit court to say something like that pretty strongly.
Yeah, the circuit court already hinted at the argument of jurisdiction. I think they might rule that she didn't have jurisdiction to have this case in the first place, might remand it back to the Reinhardt court, and Reinhardt would be like, we don't need a special master, and, you know, end of story. We'll see. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but I think that the jurisdictional argument is going to be key, because I concur with what the 11th Circuit hinted at and what the DOJ is asserting. Judge Cannon never had jurisdiction in the first place.
I don't know, again, it's a question better asked of an attorney, whether or not the circuit could throw out Cannon's jurisdiction altogether, or whether it reasonably could be filed in her district.
Yeah, well, Kais could come back and say, well, then we argue anomalous jurisdiction instead of equitable jurisdiction. And they say, all right, well, we have to start all over again and listen to that argument. I mean, who the hell knows how this will all go? Meanwhile, we've got the special master reviewing these documents. On what schedule yet? I don't know. If they go by Cannon's schedule, it'll be mid-December. So now it's kind of a race to see what gets done faster, the appeal and how it comes out, or the special master review. So I think that's kind of where we're at. Anyway.
Yep, I think that's
right. Cool. Well, I appreciate you sitting in for Andrew today, my intrepid lawyer sunning himself in Italy and eating probably all sorts of delicious foods. we'll get there one day, Pete. We'll get there one day. We just got to keep working. We just got to keep working. All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, everybody. We will be back with Cleanup on Aisle 45 next week, as you know, every Wednesday. I think Andrew might be out again, so Pete, I might see if I can tap you to sit in and answer some more questions all when right. we get more appeal information.
Sounds good.
All right, everybody, until then, I've been Allison Gill, and Pete Strzok, thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Cleanup on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Cleanup on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
They might be giants that have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one. This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant, has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.